Intervju Radija Študent.
Richard Seymour je trenutno nedvomno eden izmed vidnejših marksističnih intelektualcev. Njegovo pisanje smo v zadnjem času lahko spremljali širom internacionalnih levih in progresivnih medijev od Jacobena do Guardiana. Objavlja blog Lenin's Tomb, kjer lahko najdemo bistroumne komentarje na aktualna politična dogajanja. Kakor se za levičarja njegovega kalibra spodobi, je objavil že več knjig. Morda pa gre kot intervencijo v enega izmed dominantnih diskurzov izpostaviti Unhitched, The Trial of Christopher Hitchens, ki je šla pri versu. Njegova področja zanimanja so predvsem raznolike manifestacije razrednega boja, ki specifično kažejo v fenomenih, kot so imperializem, sionizem, islamofobija, homofobija ter raznorazna sorodna identitetna vprašanja. V Ljubljano je prišel na povabilo Inštituta za delavske študije, kjer je oddržal predavanje o zagatah socialistične organizacije, med drugim skozi prizmo prejomenjenih problemskih pol. Že prejšnji teden smo ga poklicali pred predavanjem, vendar se je pobiranje krajše izjave hitro prevesilo v skoraj poluren pogovor. Zato smo se odločili, da ga objavimo v etru. V tem trenutku smo v situaciji, ko se ob besedah socialistična organizacija, vsaj na mednarodni ravni, naše oči hitro obrnejo proti Grčiji. Toda razmere Sirizini vladi niso naklonjene in upravičeno se nam porajajo pomisleki o smeri, ki jo je ta obrala. Tako smo se Seymourja najprej vprašali, če smo v tem trenutku priča koncu poskusa Ciprasove spravne poti in ali je alternativni pristop Sirizine leve platforme tisti, v katerega moramo polagati svoje upe.
So there are a number of things there. First of all, there's the question of a social democratic approach. I think the fact is that Syriza emerges and has grown because of the crisis of social democracy. And it was catapulted to power in order to provide an alternative to social democracy, beginning with a relatively moderate program of countering austerity, investing, and ensuring that basic living conditions were supported. Well, that wasn't a radical program as such, but in the context, it was obviously far more radical than the European Union masters were prepared to allow. The big problem with Syriza when it got elected was that it didn't prepare the Greek electorate and the wider public, and particularly its own support base and its own membership, for the inevitable confrontation with the European Union. There was no way in which the European Union was going to come around, see sense, realize that they got it all wrong, and that Varoufakis was some sort of genius. So they misled people in and probably misled themselves in thinking and arguing that somehow they could both resist austerity and keep the euro. They relied upon the notion of the good Europe, that there would be allies, the French government of Hollande or the Italian government or Die Linke in Germany and just a whole series of allies would bolster their position and would act as interlocutors for them. The reality is, of course, that they haven't had any allies or interlocutors at any level. And they have been roundly humiliated and abused. They have cut deals, they've made deals with the European Union in which they essentially gave up most of their program in exchange for some cash. The cash has not been forthcoming. They are entering a fiscal crisis now because the cash hasn't been given to them. Even the cash which they are legally entitled to, I'm not talking about borrowing, but the cash that they are legally entitled to, which belongs to Greece, has not been submitted. Okay? So this is why they're now in a situation of having to requisition funds from local governments, and why they're now in a position where they don't know if they'll even be able to pay public sector workers at the end of the month. So I'm absolutely supportive of the position of the left platform of Kouvlakis and Lapavitsas. I do think that they were right to call this early on and to say that the problem is trying to stay within the institutions. If they default, yes, of course, they will have to negotiate, but if they were to default, it would have to be on a totally different terms. Lapavitsas outlines a strategy for redevelopment and growth of Greek capitalism outside the Eurozone, and that would require radical reform. It would require nationalizing key sectors of industry, particularly the banks. It would require an offensive on concentrated networks of class power. So, I mean, Lapavitsas' program, while it's framed in Keynesian language and so on, is ultimately a program of class struggle. And I think for that reason is more likely to succeed, because that is the fundamental problem here. It's not a problem of diplomacy. It's not a problem of bad ideas. It's not a problem of ideology. It is a problem of class struggle.
Toda zdi se, da je pri vsem tem neka zagata. Mar je mogoče reči, da obstaja, recimo temu, neka strukturna tendenca k temu, da se leva stranka obrača proti centru? Poleg Sirize je pod udarom komentatorjev v tem trenutku tudi španski Podemos, za katerega se zdi, da je znotraj svojih struktur krenil proti precej nedemokratični notranji ureditvi, na kar je nedavno s svojim izstopom iz Podemosa opozoril tudi njegov soustanovitelj Juan Carlos Mondero, ki je stranko ocenil tudi kot premikajočo se na desno. Zato nas je zanimalo, mar ni mogoče reči, da se to vrstne stranke po formativnem obdobju, ko dobijo vodstveni kader, precej centralizirajo? In ali ni ravno ta centralizacija eden izmed razlogov, da se stranka sama pomakne bolj v desno, da se njeni glavni akteri začnejo iti klasično igro političnega kompromisarstva?
I understand, and I agree to some extent. I don't think that Syriza is anything like as undemocratically centralized as Podemos. I mean, I really think Podemos has a problem in its political structure. And that far too much emphasis is placed upon an active and highly empowered centralized leadership and a relatively passive membership base, many of whom don't even pay subs, you know. So if you don't pay subscriptions, in what sense are you an active member? So this is a step backward, I think, democratically speaking. I think in some respects, Podemos is even less democratic than many problematically so-called democratic centralist parties, you know, the old Leninist parties. So that's something to think about. I mean, it came out of a democratic movement. It came out of almost an autonomous kind of moment, you know, in political struggle. And it's developed this centralized structure. That said, I think a degree of centralization is necessary and inevitable, and I'm not opposed at all to the idea of leadership, provided it is accountable and provided it's democratic in a genuinely democratic way. The problem with centralization when you're going for governmental power, when you're trying to wield office, is what will tend to happen is, I mean, and Robert Michel was right about this to some extent, you take office and the centralized leadership occupies the apparatuses of the state. Very quickly it finds itself faced with a whole series of problems that it needs the state apparatuses, you know, the civil servants and so on, to help them with. It needs to make connections with businessmen. It needs to make connections with international diplomats. And pretty soon it finds that this centralized sort of apparatus has got a whole series of connections within and beyond the state with the ruling class, and they act as a constant pressure. And maybe they come to find that they've got a little bit more in common with those guys because they're a party of government and they're trying to administer in a way that works. And then they find that the pressure is on them to discipline their own party members whose demands are being experienced as irresponsible, as disruptive, and so on. And so they develop a more centralized and less democratic approach. And you end up with something like what we have in the social democratic parties, like New Labour. You know, I don't even know if you can call it social democratic anymore. But essentially, where party democracy is a hollow, empty sham, where there's actually relatively little that one can do within the party. I think that the relationship is one in which a middle-class professional leadership works to discipline and convert the base. So you've got this middle-class professional leadership that is integrated into neoliberal statecraft, that is, and here I'm talking about social democratic parties, integrated into neoliberal statecraft, trying to discipline a more left-leaning base into accepting neoliberal ideologies and going out and advocating them in their communities. I fear that unless they have a much more radical confrontation within the state, this fate could befall Syriza. It hasn't yet. I mean, they still are fighting. I mean, there's still a government of struggle to an extent, but there are pressures on them, and already you can see that they are tempted, and many of their government ministers have been tempted to clamp down on the radicalization. I don't know if you saw recently, one of their ministers was arguing that the police should be allowed to shut down university occupations. So there's these divisions are opening up already. As for Podemos, I think they may be the best we can get in this situation. It's not obvious to me that they are taking votes away from a better left-wing rival, but we should retain a healthy critique of their practice.
V zadnjem času je ena vročih tem imigracija v EU. Tema, ki jo razne nove desne populistične stranke zlorabljajo za pridobitev glasov preko širjenja rasne in verske nestrpnosti. In tema, ki je bila v zadnjem času posebej podžgana strani pariške Charlie Hebdo tragedije ter mnogih prevrnjenih ladij na poti čez Mediteran. Toda žal se zdi, da levici še ni uspelo prepričljivo nastopiti glede teh vprašanj in da so se govori o kulturni komponenti teh tem kar množili. Medtem ko je njihova socialna nota nekako poniknila v ozadje mimo govora o sočutju. Je torej mogoče reči, da levici ni uspelo v javnem diskurzu povezati problema položaja priseljencev in problema razrednega boja?
Well, the first thing to say is I think we should be very specific and clear about what we mean by multiculturalism. In the United Kingdom, multiculturalism is an official discourse. That's how it begins life, as an official discourse, wherein you get, celebrations of steel bands from Trinidad and sari wearing women from India. And you say, that's multiculturalism. We tolerate all the different cultures. And what that does is that it freezes and fetishizes culture. And it's a false kind of respect. It infantilizes, in fact, people of different backgrounds by assuming that they all defer to this frozen, static idea of culture. Cultures develop, they hybridize, they proliferate, and this is what we would expect. So multiculturalism in its inception as a discourse has some flaws. That said, in the UK today, and I think more generally across Europe, the backlash against multiculturalism is a coded form of a backlash against a multiracial society. So when the right wing goes on the attack against multiculturalism, where in Germany you see the discourse of late culture, where in Britain you see the discourse of British values, These nationalist ideas being used to control multiculturalism, it's actually a way of attacking multiracialism and controlling and attacking racially oppressed minorities. So that's the first thing. I think a lot of the leftist responses, the better leftist responses, have been radically anti-racist. They have highlighted the fact that France, for example, when we talk about Charlie Hebdo, France is a very racially hierarchized society, that a large part of its working class is racially oppressed, that it's some of it's prisons. You know, about 65% of the prison population is Muslim. That rises to 80% in the Île-de-France. And, you know, that there are tremendous geographical and economic forms of segregation at work there. Now, you cannot talk about class struggle in France unless you talk about the modalities in which class has lived. And race is a key modality in which class has lived. Now, why is it that the Communist Party or any of the left parties, the Nouveau Parti Anticapitaliste or any of the others, have not been able to organize in these banlieues? Why have they not been able to get these young men and bring them together in a militant formation? And why is it that these ultra-reactionary jihadi groups, who started out as a kind of dance army of jihad, you know, kind of feckless, incompetent little rabble, before graduating by fighting in Syria and Iraq and so on, why did these jihadis even stand a chance? It's because the left vacated its historic responsibility to argue for the self-organization of the racially oppressed. And so when we talk about immigration, what we have to start with is the fact that immigrants are themselves part of the working class, and that they are their oppression, their exclusion, the forms of segregation to which they're subject, are means of attacking and stratifying and dividing the working class. And therefore, what one should begin with doing is trying to organize those workers, trying to organize migrants in their own self-defense. They are the most powerless. They are the most victimized. We need to get trade unions and other groups involved in defending them. Where trade unions have been active, and in, to their credit, in Britain, many trade unions have taken a very good line on this, Unite the Union, for example, in trying to organize migrant workers. It's been successful. It's helped break down some of the barriers. It's also helped migrant workers to get better conditions. And so I think that has to be the way in which we approach it. It's about organization. The one other thing that I would say about this is that we need to overcome what is a kind of methodological nationalism that imprisons all of us. When we talk about migration, the assumption of common sense in Britain, and I suspect elsewhere, is that if foreign people come over and start working in Britain, they're taking our jobs. The jobs somehow belong to us. But this is not the way the economy works anymore. I don't even know if it ever really worked that way, but certainly today it doesn't. We have an increasingly regionalized world system where economies are integrated on a regional basis, and the European Union is a politically constituted free trade zone, a politically constituted market. And therefore, when British workers want to find a job, many of them are seeking work across the European Union. And likewise, workers from Poland and Romania and elsewhere are seeking work in Britain. The laws, the logic of supply and demand, of job creation and so on, apply across the whole zone. And therefore, when people think that if you set up immigration barriers across this free trade zone, that this will somehow help workers, it won't. What it will actually do is it will leave capital with total freedom of movement. But it will maintain workers in areas of artificially high unemployment because they won't be able to move to where the jobs are. So I think we have to start this argument from a totally different set of premises than those which usually appear in the bourgeois press and so on. Unfortunately, the arguments of the left aren't often heard, and I think another part of the problem is that a big part of the left is utterly, utterly chauvinist on these issues.
Glede na to, da so eni izmed glavnih branilcev sekularne domneve univerzalnosti tako imenovani novi ateisti, eden izmed virov protiislamske ideologije in da je Seymour celo napisal knjigo o Hitchensu, pa nas je za konec zanimalo kaj več o tem. Kako komentirati od kakega Richarda Dawkinsa večkrat izrečeno logiko, po kateri so razmere v določenih predeljih islamskega sveta nevzdržne zaradi religioznega fundamentalizma in ne, da je le ta posledica nevzdržnih razmer?
Yes. Well, this is a new idealism. which the War on Terror did much to produce. And Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins are all avatars of this new idealism. What this boils down to, is the idea that God, the imaginary notion of God, is responsible for most of the world's problems. And that if only we can persuade people not to hold bad ideas, in other words, not to believe in God, then the problem will go away. And when you read Dawkins, and when you read Hitchens, and when you read Sam Harris, what is striking is that they rely upon a very literalist, often very eccentric, I have to say, but very literalist, almost fundamentalist interpretation of the religious texts and the religious traditions. And those interpretations are said to be the truth of Islam or Christianity or Judaism, and those meanings are said to be responsible for the material problems that we face. The irony of this situation is that when Tony Blair and Christopher Hitchens had a debate a few years ago, they talked about Israel-Palestine, they talked about Northern Ireland, and it was Tony Blair who had to point out that the problems in Israel-Palestine had a lot more to do with nationality and injustice than to do with religion. And I was staggered that this man, this war criminal, had to be the one to point this out, while Christopher Hitchens was banging on about religion and blaming the monotheisms of both sides for it. And coming from Northern Ireland, as I do, I always detected a whiff of metropolitan snobbery and disdain when people blamed everything on religion. I had to explain to people when I moved to London that actually the conflict is not primarily about religion. Everybody thinks it is, but nobody in Northern Ireland really believes it's about religion. We know that it's about politics. It's about which country do you want to belong to? What state should rule? So it's a colonial question. Should the British Empire rule, or should Ireland be reunited as a republic? And for those English metropolitan writers who want to talk about it in religious terms, what they're actually saying is, look at these silly, backward, barbarian people with their silly, backward, barbarian ideas, killing each other over their silly, backward, barbarian notions. And that perspective has a uniquely exonerating aspect, because it excludes from its purview the role of imperialism. And this is very important for Christopher Hitchens, of course, because he began this turn to the new atheism round about 2004, 2005. Actually, when you look at his writings, that's when he begins to start to focus on it, particularly around 2005. And what was happening at that time? The Iraq occupation was going awry. It was going to shit. And essentially, the country was being torn by a civil war on the one hand, and the soldiers were no longer being welcomed by anyone, but were being shot at. And he had to explain this. He said it would be a cakewalk. He said there wouldn't even be a war, so bring it on. Suddenly there was a war, and he had to explain this. He had to explain why Iraqis weren't grateful for American imperialism. So this was really about him trying to rationalize a world historic analysis that he had brought to bear. You know, he thought the American Revolution is the only one left standing, liberal democracy is all that's left standing, and therefore we have to fight on the side of progress, and anything that isn't American liberal capitalism is backward and reactionary and barbaric. And therefore, if we're on the right side of history, we shouldn't have any problem winning. When he finds out that America might be having a problem winning, and that being on the right side of history doesn't seem to be working for it, he has to explain it. That's when he starts to turn to the reductionist interpretations of religion.
Poslušali ste Richarda Seymourja, s katerim se je pogovarjal Nates. Nasvidenje v naslednji revoluciji.
Intervju Radija Študent.